I'm Max Bergman of the Center for American Progress, and I'm with Michael Anton of the Weekly Standard, and we're going to be talking about the nuclear week that was, the what some are calling the Prague Spring. And so I think, Michael, to just kick it off, I think maybe the first thing we should talk about is the New START Treaty, which I think seemed to catch the most news and be the most notable.
Yeah, I agree. I guess I could start. It was a... I found something in the treaty that other people noticed that disturbed me that I wrote about in the Standard this issue, current issue, which is despite what the administration had said that there would not be any constraints on missile defense, there is a constraint in there on missile defense, a provision that disallows the U.S. from reusing retired SLBM or ICBM launchers in the missile defense program should we want to do that. And I guess I think that I have a problem with that because I don't want to place constraints on missile defense. I'm a believer in missile defense. But I also think it was an unforced error on the administration's part, in both in that they didn't really tell the exact honest truth about it in advance, knowing full well that this provision was in the treaty and knowing full well that the text of the treaty was going to have to be released and everyone would see it. They had to know that the likes of John Kyle and John McCain would read it and find it and get upset, and that's, of course, exactly what happened. And I think it makes ratification a little bit more complicated for them, and in a way that it didn't need to be. So I'm wondering why they did this. I mean, I guess I know part of the answer is they did it because the Russians wanted them to do it, and they wanted a treaty, and so they stuck that in there. But the way they handled it, I think, is going to come back and bite them.
No, I agree. I think it definitely will complicate ratification. I disagree that thinking that I think it. I think from the administration standpoint that this isn't a limitation on our current missile defense plans, that this won't limit the missile silos that were at Vandenberg in California, that we essentially aren't planning on doing anything
right.
else that would involve the conversion of these.
I think that they would have to fall back on that phrase, current or planned. Well, since we weren't planning to reuse any, you know, if we take the missile, for instance, the Minutemen down from 450 to 400, which is apparently what... You know, the treaty doesn't say exactly what your mix of launchers has to be, but the talk that I'm hearing is they're going to go down to 400. And, well, now we can't reuse those silos, those launchers. And even though we weren't planning to, who knows what the future might bring. There might be a contingency in which we would want to do that, and now we can't because we signed it away with the treaty. At least we can if the treaty is ratified. And I think even if it's not ratified, the administration, like any administration that signs a treaty and doesn't ratify it, is going to... consider itself bound by the text of the treaty.
Right. Well, I think on missile defense, I think, you know, first thing, I think the Russians simply wanted that if you're going to reduce launchers and create limits on launchers, they wanted to make sure that those limits on launchers weren't going to be used to actually distort the strategic balance.
They wouldn't. I mean, this is, I think, I have to interject here, and I'm sorry, because I think that we're buying into, let's not buy into the Russian line. Which is anything the U.S. does on missile defense affects our, meaning the Russian strategic posture, when they know full well that we have never tried to design a system that could affect theirs. They could overwhelm us if they wanted. They just don't want us, really, it seems to me, to be protected from anybody's missiles.
And, Michael, I think one of the great things that's in this treaty, and I actually think it's kind of a win for missile defense supporters, because it actually includes language that the Russians say that the current missile defense plans do not impact Soviet nuclear decisions. So, you know, I think that by putting
right,
that
it goes
in
on, it goes on to say that as force levels come down, it makes an explicit link that hasn't been made before. It goes on to say that as force levels come down, missile defense is going to have to be part of all future discussions.
Michael, let me jump in here for a second, because I think the key issue here is that if our missile defense plans that we have go forward, that the Russians now have no problems with those missile defense plans. But if our missile defense plans change and we develop the sort of super duper Star Wars system that was
which
once
we're not really researching or talking about at all right now.
But no. But right. But in the START Treaty, that according to the START Treaty, that basically the current missile defense plans that we have that are going to include long range missile defense is acceptable to the Russians. What would not be acceptable to the Russians under the START Treaty?
Well, if it's acceptable to the Russians, then why did they strong arm us into killing the Eastern European sites, which again they could have easily overwhelmed and did not affect their strategic posture?
Well, I think that's an entirely different different subject. I don't think they strong-armed us into doing anything. I think we decided that...
they complained loudly, and we decided as a gesture of goodwill that we would give them up in order to get some more cooperation from the Russians. And we did give them up, and they seem to have pocketed that gesture of goodwill and not decided to make a commensurate gesture of goodwill.
Well, we can agree to disagree on the on what the Obama administration's rationale is here. My view was that the shift in missile defense plans was to focus more on the missiles that Iran actually has, the short and more intermediate range missiles, and not the longer term missiles. And so therefore that was a shift in plans. And as the Russians actually learned more about what the Obama administration's missile defense plan was in Europe, they became less amenable to that, and therefore fought the treaty much harder in January and December and over the last few months. So, you know, I think that what this treaty does is essentially say that what U.S. plans are on missile defense are perfectly acceptable. Now, if the U.S. decides to vastly change its missile defense plans and vastly and turn it into a 1980s-style Star Wars program, then the Russians are going to have a strategic concern about missile defense. And I think, therefore, you know, that's fine, because then if we do decide to do that in the future, then we can always withdraw from the treaty. So if a new, you know, Republican administration comes in and decides that the technology has improved to such a great degree that we want to have this super duper missile defense system, then they can we can abrogate the treaty, just as the Russians can abrogate the treaty if they see that we are doing that. So I think the missile defense issue is just not, it's one that if you're searching for an issue with this treaty, that it's something that you can try to grasp onto. But I think really what it does is just sort of lock in the status quo and actually gains Russian acceptance.
I disagree on again, two points. One is, sure, we were always, again, we made a political decision, we meaning the United States, long ago, made a political decision that, yes, we were going to proceed with missile defense, but not exactly along the lines that Reagan initially envisioned in the 1980s and that Edward Teller and others were pushing. And part of the we cited technological reasons that we just don't think it's feasible yet to develop a system that can defeat hundreds or thousands of missiles, and political reasons or strategic reasons that it would upset the strategic balance and it wasn't worth pursuing. So what we were going to do is deliberately design a limited system that could defeat or defend us against limited launches by a country like North Korea or Iran.
Right.
We're talking tens or dozens at most at once. So something that Russia or China could easily overwhelm should not trouble them at all in terms of their own strategic posture, their own ability to threaten the U.S. homeland in the event of a conflict. We made that decision. And we have pursued that decision now for about 20 years. All our R&D has gone along those lines. We haven't even looked at the kind of thing you're talking about, except in the most rudimentary paper and pencil and calculator kind of way, now since the 80s, as far as I know.
I completely agree with you.
What the new text, the reason why I'm upset by this treaty is, if we get into a situation where North Korea or Iran or some other country or combination of countries can field missiles into the 10s and 20s and 30s, and we don't have enough launchers, and we need to move quickly to adapt, we now don't have the flexibility to reuse retired ICBM launchers. And we don't have it precisely because we wrote it out of existence in a treaty with a country that wouldn't be affected by our use of those launchers. I just don't see the logic in that, except that it limits missile defense, which is something the Russians always want us to do because they don't like it. I think they don't like it for a couple of reasons. One is it's an area where we're simply more technologically advanced than they are, and we can afford to be and they can't. And so they would like us – they would like to restrain us in any way they can. And I have to think that, especially we can tie this into Iran, given the support that the Russians give to the Iranian nuclear program and various military programs, the Russians must seem to – They must enjoy the fact or take some solace from the fact that we are threatened by the missiles of rogue nations, and they would be unhappy if we were defended from the missiles of rogue nations, which is one of the reasons why they constantly try to limit whatever we do on missile defense, including the Eastern European sites, which, again, the Russians could have overwhelmed. And those were – I've said this to people in the past. If you wonder why those sites were important, take a globe, get a piece of string, put one thumb on Tehran and stretch the piece of string over Eastern Europe, and you see where the string leads. It leads essentially to the northeastern seaboard of the United States. That's why those sites were there.
Right. Well, let me just say, I think the Russians have a variety of strategic reasons why they do things, and I don't necessarily disagree with your strategic interpretation. And I think I could go on about how missile defense is, the actual tests aren't as effective as is claimed to be, and that the threat from North Korea that under the current missile defense plan that we can actually address that. But my basic argument is that under this START treaty, that our current plans for missile defense that were also the plans of the Bush administration can proceed, and that if we decided that we had to drastically change the situation regarding missile defense, that we can then do that. So, and I think it's incredibly important that the Russians actually accepted language that said missile defense does not, the current missile defense plan doesn't threaten
that. I interpret that passage entirely differently. I think you're placing more emphasis or importance on the first half. You're talking about the language in the preamble, all right? And I place more importance on the second half of that statement, where it says, as levels rise, though, this is going to become more important, and we're gonna right. look for linkage between the two sides. Now, I don't see that as, you seem to be interpreting that as the Russians making a concession to us. I see it more as us making a concession to them. I don't think a Bush administration would have agreed to that language in the preamble, for instance.
Well, let's agree to disagree there, and perhaps move on to some of the other aspects of the treaty.
Well, I want to mention one other point about the treaty that I thought was a little sneaky, too, and I'm wondering, but the administration seems to have gotten away with it, which is, this issue of the cuts down to 1550, but as you probably know, there is a little bit of funny accounting in the bomber counting rule, so that a bomber counts either as one delivery system or as one warhead. And as we know, certain Russian bombers can fly, I forgot the exact mix, but some of them can fly with 16 bombs, some of them can fly with 6 or 8, depending on how the pilots
are. And some of ours can fly with 25.
Right. If you do the math, and if both sides are starting to send up fully loaded bombers, which basically nobody ever does and hasn't done since the early 1990s, but supposing you wanted to do that, actually this treaty allows for an increase of about 10% above the 2200 level over the Moscow Treaty. And I dug around and asked some people who claim to know why that provision is in there, and the answer I got back was because the Russians did not want to allow U.S. inspections at the storage facilities, the bomb storage facilities at their air bases. And so it's easy enough to count airplanes, which we don't even have to inspect the airfields. We can see them from satellite reconnaissance and other things, so we just decided we'd count airplanes as one weapon. Right. I don't know. That struck me as a little gimmicky and cynical. To claim that a 30% reduction, or to claim a 30% reduction when, if you read the fine print, there's really a 10% increase.
Well, I think with the bomber counting rule, that there's always been a question of how you count bombers, because a bomber can possess zero nuclear weapons or it can possess as many as 25. And actually, if you were to just go and inspect a bomber, you would not find any nuclear weapons. And one thing that this treaty does is it actually counts the number of warheads that are deployed on ICBMs and SLBMs.
Yeah.
It's not that complicated
because, for instance, we count a MIRVed missile and the submarine missiles can still be MIRVed even under START II, which was
if you were to go and count bombers, you would find that you would count them as zero. And what's actually happened in the past is that there weren't provisions to actually count the number of warheads. And so there's always been this arbitrary method of how you count bombers. And the Bush administration's 2002 Moscow Treaty also didn't sort of...
Well, it didn't cover launchers at all. It didn't cover...
Right.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. Like, the Russians and the U.S. could simply, build a ton of... build a lot more bombers and put nuclear weapons on these bombers.
All it has to do is fly fully loaded the bombers it already has, and you're above the Moscow limits.
But what happens in most of these treaties that have happened in the past, there is this sort of favoritism towards bombers. And the reason why is because bombers, A, can be called back. It's not an instantaneous launch. And B, they can also be shot down. So there is a bit of a time lag between pressing the button and that bomber actually
getting there. Well, that's a good segue to the nuclear posture review, because
Let me say a couple. I don't want to get away from the START Treaty quite yet,
because
you were able to say some negative things about it. I want to say a couple positive
things.
And I might even say
a positive thing or two about it, but I'll let you go first.
Well, I think in principle, I think your point about the bomber rule is that this isn't as far-reaching as the bomber administration claims it is. And, you know, I could quite I'm willing to accept that on the merits of what's actually in the treaty. I think it isn't a significant treaty for a few reasons. I think one, it does extend the verification regime that did lend confidence between U.S. and Russia relations. That was a byproduct of the initial START treaty that Reagan negotiated. And the second thing is I think this does lay the groundwork for future collaboration on other issues, not just nuclear issues, but importantly on nuclear issues for addressing issues that we really care about, which is Russian tactical nuclear weapons and also non-deployed, the thousands of non-deployed nuclear weapons.
I would certainly like to see all that happen.
I'm sorry?
I would certainly like to see all that happen. I mean,
yeah, and I think this now puts pressure on the administration to actually deliver on the next one, which is going to be much more difficult and much more controversial here at home and also in Russia. And, you know, there's indications that the Russians may be kind of wary. But I think this does set the stage for something that could be.
And that's going to be a hard treaty to do because, as I think you know, the imbalance between the U.S. tactical posture and the Russian tactical posture is enormous. Federation of American Scientists, as I read them, estimates that the Russians retain about 5,400. And nobody knows what the U.S. level is, but it's less than 500, and of which only about 200 are deployed. That is a conversation the Russians have never wanted to have and still don't want to have. It's going to be very hard to get them to begin talking about it. And I was encouraged, for instance, to see it, you know, before we get to the nuclear posture group, but I'll just mention that one of the things I was encouraged by in the NPR was it specifically mentioned that imbalance and that that's something we have to talk about. I agree. I think it is. I don't know how to get it. Conversation going, and I don't know if it'll get anywhere, but it is something that definitely needs to be raised. And it all points to something sort of troubling, which remember the 2001 NPR, which was not an unclassified document. By the way, I will commend the Obama administration for doing theirs in a fully unclassified way and putting it out. I think that was a wise way to go, and I'm just glad I got to read it. So yeah. I personally benefited from that decision. One of the things that people criticized the leaks out of the Bush 2001 NPR for was its supposed expansion of the role that nuclear weapons play in U.S. defense policy. It's an underappreciated story over the past 20 years is the extent to which Russian policy has expanded the role of nuclear weapons in Russia's defense policy, and precisely as compensation for Russian drawdowns on the conventional side as Russia has become smaller and poorer. And that's one of the reasons why they don't want to have this conversation about the tactical nuclear weapons is because they realize that that is one of the most powerful cards they still have in the deck and that it compensates significantly for the decline in their conventional posture. And I think it's just going to make it all the harder to get that conversation going or fruitful when the Russians keep elevating or at least holding it on a higher level than they did during the Cold War, the importance of nuclear weapons to their own force planning.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that's going to be one of the major challenges. I mean, the fact is that the Russian state of the Russian conventional forces is not good, and I think you know that's part of the reason why I think the concern over the bomber counting rule is kind of misguided. That I don't think we have to fear you know a Russian breakout capability, especially in terms of conventional bombers.
But I agree, we don't. Although. You know, there have been those incidents, some recent incidents of the Russians flying bomber patrols into the Western Hemisphere recently.
Right.
And we don't know what was on those planes, and probably nothing was. But, it's something the United States hasn't done since, I think, 1991 or 2.
And, you know, the Russians clearly took a more hostile approach as relations sort of fell apart in the later years of the Bush administration. And, you know, I think part of, you know, I think you raise all legitimate points about why this is going to be really difficult. But I think that's part of the challenge of, you know, the Obama administration is taking on through the reset of U.S.-Russian relations, that hopefully that the START Treaty is the starting point to actually build more cooperative relations where we can actually move beyond the Cold War sort of postures where we both sort of still view each other as enemies. And, that, you know, rebuilding that relationship is going to be vital for the next steps in nuclear disarmament.
I'd like to believe all of this, but as a veteran of the Bush 43 administration, I was there in the first term, and I remember you know, my boss is the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, a Russia expert, who was very hopeful about relations at the time, getting beyond the Cold War. The president himself used the phrase new strategic relationship over and over again, and it seemed like there was a sort of brief spring. You remember the famous comment, looked into his soul, from the summer of 2001, the great Russian gesture of canceling their military exercises after 9/11 and not objecting to U.S. basing in Central Asia for the war in Afghanistan. And it seemed like that little spring didn't last very long, though. And it seems like the trajectory has been down ever since, and it hasn't really improved with the Obama administration. And I'm not necessarily saying the Obama administration has done anything wrong, but it seems like there's a bipartisan consensus on Americans' part that we just got to keep being nice, and they'll eventually reciprocate, and the Russians don't seem to be in the mood to reciprocate, no matter who is being nice.
Well, I don't know if it's about just being nice. I think part of it was, when the Bush administration came into office, that there was a sort of shift in Russian approach towards the West. That the reaction to Yeltsin, which wasn't the Bush administration's fault, and so hopefully now the Russians are sort of moving away from some of the anti-Western approaches of the last decade. I mean, I'm not enough of a U.S.-Russia expert, but I think that that in order to get that next step on disarmament and arms control, it's going to have to take a sort of a transformation of U.S.-Russia relations where we actually don't view each other as adversaries. I mean, the only reason why I think we possess thousands of nuclear weapons, almost 10,000, is because the Russians have that many as well. And so we're both going to have to start to come down together.
I guess nobody knows, but my best estimate of our stockpile is closer to 6, maybe below that.
Okay.
So,
I mean, there's been other
somebody knows.
I've seen other estimates. Someone knows, but they're not broadcasting that on the internet.
Yeah.
So, do you want to talk about the NPR and some of your thoughts?
Sure. The big news out of the NPR was, of course, the change in declaratory policy, and I think it has been oversold on both the left and the right, and yet I nonetheless found something to complain about that I objected to. It was oversold because, and I was surprised by the New York Times piece that came out on the Tuesday, the day the NPR was released, which is based on an interview with the president the day before. It was written in part by Sanger, who must know better, but it was written as if no such thing as a negative security assurance had ever been issued, when, of course, the first ones were articulated by the United States in 1978. This is not a new policy. What in particular was new is the specific restriction on ChemBio with respect to NPT, signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, in good standing. Okay,
right.
We had always kept that ambiguous. And in fact, as I wrote in a piece in the Standard this week, the U.S. rather ambiguously, although I don't think it was that ambiguous, there was a line that I liked that got cut. I said, our threats in the past have been sort of like as ambiguous as Tony Soprano inquiring about the health of your family. The words may not be spoken, but you do get the message. We pretty forcefully threatened nuclear retaliation had the Iraqis in 1991 used chemical or biological weapons in the war, and they didn't. And afterward, a couple of them said, the reason we didn't is because we thought you guys would nuke us. That struck me as a really great example of deterrence at work. Now, the text of the NPR makes it unclear whether or not we could still do that. There's a caveat attached to the bio assurance, which says essentially, we reserve the right to change our mind. It doesn't say what the circumstances might be, but it just says, in case the bio threat grows or gets worse, we might change our mind. And there is no caveat attached to the chemical weapons threat, however, or the chemical weapons exemption, I'm sorry. So it sounds like in the future, the U.S. has forsworn the ability to threaten nuclear retaliation for chemical weapons attacks. And I guess I'm discouraged by that because of the Iraq experience in 91 when it seemed to have worked. Also because one of the reasons the United States gave up developing CBW, chemical and biological weapons, apart from the fact that they're just disgusting and abhorrent, was because we said, look, we have a nuclear arsenal. We don't need these to threaten tit-for-tat retaliation. Right. And, well, now we seem to have forsworn that in the NPR, and I wonder if it doesn't, in fact, encourage people or other countries, rogue nations, bad actors, to develop CBW stocks in the same way that supposedly getting a negative security assurance is supposed to discourage you from developing nuclear weapons, if you follow that.
Yeah. No, I think the concerns over this are as unsurprisingly a little overblown. That I think the you know, the fact is that U.S. conventional forces have shown over the last two decades that there are that they are a tremendous deterrent against a regime taking action. That, you know, in some ways, I'm going to say something that I, you know, would rather not say, but Rumsfeld was right about troop levels in Iraq in the sense that you didn't need 100,000 troops to actually take out a weak, you know, despot regime. That the American that the American conventional forces have now become so powerful, and also with the ability, you know, with precision guided munitions, able to target you know, adversaries really directly. So the point I think is that, you know, chem and bio weapons. First, states aren't really developing these weapons, and that, you know, that these weapons are not as deadly as a nuclear attack. So that if, you know, a regime in some time in the future were to develop or use a chemical weapon or a biological weapon, that we could actually handle that with our conventional forces. But the second thing is that it does have the caveat that if this was actually a devastating attack, or if these weapons grew in their capability,
only on bio, does not on chemical.
Okay, sure. But then we could respond. We would respond with our nuclear capability. And I think the third point also is that, you know, the debate over declaratory policy. There are a lot of complaints also, you know, from arms control advocates calling for no first use and sole purpose, and which I think would have been fine. But I don't think
I know. So I was pleased not to see that in there.
Right, but we still possess nuclear weapons, and I think it's possessing nuclear weapons, as Steve Walt noted, is you know, that implies something, you know, that we have these weapons when we probably have them for a reason, and so that, you know, declaratory policy can also change, and I think it's also important to note that the NPR is not some document that is going to last for 50 years. This is to outline the administration's approach towards nuclear weapons, and, you know, over the next. You know, basically over the next, it could be as short as 3 years, but it could be 7 years. Over this period, I think this NPR really just simply reflects the reality of the situation in which that, you know, chem and bio weapons, states don't really have them and aren't going to, you know, are unlikely to deploy them against us. But if they did, they would not rise to the level that would.
Well, this points to a central difficulty in this whole discussion, about which I don't think we're going to disagree much, but then we'll disagree sort of at the end, which is, you know, it's almost impossible. Anybody who knows American politics, including foreign observers, has to know it's almost impossible to imagine a scenario in which any American president will use nuclear weapons, will order the use of nuclear weapons. I mean, it has to be the end of the world or close to it before we're going to do it.
Yeah.
The problem with that is, to the extent that bad actors come to have confidence that, well, no matter what we do, the Americans won't play that card, they're going to get bolder. And I personally think that I'd rather have them off balance, scared of us, and thinking that we're a little crazy, and you just never know what the Americans might do if you push them too hard. So the more we try to soothe feelings and smooth these things over in the minds of a mullah or a Saddam or a Kim Jong-il, et cetera, I just don't want them at ease about this. Even though the reality is they probably could push us almost to the very, very edge and not get that response, even with the chem bio attack, I don't want them to know that. I don't want them to feel that.
Well, what I would say, I think, you know, I'll say sort of two things. I think the first thing is that I think people are rogue countries are afraid of us, and that, you know, our conventional forces, they're afraid of our conventional forces and our ability to use
them. Wait, can I just interject one thing? That brings up a point I wanted to make before when you said that conventional forces deter. But Iraq, twice in the last 20 years, is a great example of them not deterring. Saddam invaded Kuwait. We amassed a big coalition. We say, if you don't get out, we're going to kick you out conventionally. And he wasn't deterred. He stayed and made us kick him out conventionally. And he had to know he was going to lose.
20 years ago.
And in 2003, the same thing happened. We said, you know, open up your stocks, comply with everything, disarm, et cetera. And he had to know he was going to lose. And, of course, he did lose. And he wasn't deterred. And we had to go in and, of course, do it. Deterrence is when the threat of something actually dissuades the other side from doing it. And that, to me, is an example of the example of him not using conventional biological weapons when he could have is an example of deterrence, not you know, holding on to the last minute and then losing a war you were fated to lose because you can't beat U.S. forces.
Right. Well, what I would say to that, and you know, I think the two things that I would say, I think one, you know, Iraq, Saddam Hussein clearly miscalculated. But I think the example of our conventional military forces demonstrated that, and that's, I think, part of the reality that's reflected in the NPR 7 years after that initial invasion, that we do have this tremendous capability and that, you know, countries should be aware that we have this capability. But, you know, we also possess nuclear weapons in general. And you know, I think that also just sends a signal that, you know, we are willing to use them. And I think, importantly, on Iran and North Korea, that we haven't talked about the caveat, which says if you're not compliant with the non-proliferation treaty, and you know, who decides who's non-compliant with the non-proliferation treaty? Well, we do.
Yeah.
And the second point is that I think where we sort of just generally disagree in our approaches is that, you know, I think you're focused on we need to dissuade bad actors that we can seriously nuke them and that we are willing to do this. And we're a little bit crazy and don't mess with us. And, you know, what I would say to that is I think, you know, that has some importance and it's important that bad actors know that we're serious and that we are willing to, you know, go all out against them. And, you know, I think this NPR shows that we didn't give up first strike capability and other things. But I think the second thing is that if we approach issues in that way, that what it does is it also alienates others that aren't our enemies, that are sort of in the middle. They may not really like the United States, or they may not, you know, really have an opinion about the United States, but they, you know, are maybe going along with the NPT. But if countries lose faith in our leadership and view us as a little crazy and as a little nutty, then I think that is not necessarily good for future non-proliferation efforts. I don't think that's good for stopping the spread of nuclear weapons or confronting other international issues such as
nuclear terrorism. I think we definitely do disagree here because my view is the countries that are hell-bent on getting nuclear weapons are going to do so anyway. They're not going to be dissuaded by declaratory policy, and they're not going to be encouraged by a negative security assurance. You know, I don't think a negative security assurance is going to change Iranian behavior at all.
I agree. I don't think that was about changing.
I'm not sure there is a middle whom we're necessarily alienating. And I think also the record matters more than what you say on this in the end. And the record is of non-use since 1945. And like I say, anybody who knows anything about American politics has to know that it's got to be close to the end of the world before an American president is going to order something like that. I doubt that making the minds of the bad guys at ease somehow puts the minds of the people in the middle less at ease or makes them.
I'm not saying put the minds of the bad guys at ease. What I'm saying is
you're right. That's too far on my part.
Yeah. No. What I'm saying is that if you go to another level where it's sort of like, you know, where it's incredibly aggressive blustering rhetoric.
I don't think that describes our posture prior to this was incredibly blustering. I mean, we blustered when we had to.
It depends on who you're talking about within the administration.
I mean, if you go back and read what Bush, 41, Baker, Cheney actually said to either directly to Iraqi interlocutors or in public pronouncements in 1990 and 91. Okay, you could call it bluster, but it was a very specific context in the face of a very specific threat in a very specific circumstance. For the most part, you know, the United States doesn't bluster like that. And if you want to talk about bluster, let's go back to the massive retaliation speech. I mean, that's probably the biggest bluster the U.S. has ever put on. This is, by the way, to listeners who may not be familiar with it. In 1953, the Secretary of State declared that basically the U.S. response to any Soviet provocation or any Soviet provocation that we deem sufficiently provocative would be an all-out nuclear strike on the Soviet Union. And we later updated it to include China and Eastern Europe and even North Korea. That's pretty hardcore, boy, when it comes to making nuclear threats. And we're talking about that would have been the response even to conventional attacks.
No,
the doctrine that we dialed back in the early Kennedy administration. But we have been a lot more cowboyish and harsh in our nuclear posture in the past, and one of the things that's frustrated me a little bit about the coverage of the current NPR has been, I think, the mistaken impression that it somehow is this sane alternative to the craziness of the Bush 43 years when it came to nuclear doctrine, a doctrine that I don't think was that crazy.
Well, I mean, we can disagree with the merits of the Bush doctrine. I think where we are in agreement, though, is that, you know, this NPR, is this Nuclear Posture Review, is not some sort of earth-shattering document that is that necessarily, you know, will transform U.S. nuclear policy. I think, you know, I think it's a fairly modest document. But the thing I think I like about it is it does leave open the possibility for greater reductions in U.S. nuclear arsenal. It does, in some ways, decrease the role of nuclear weapons, the thing that we were just talking about, whether we would use them vis-a-vis bio and chem. And I think it does actually place an increased focus on the threat of nuclear terrorism and especially nuclear forensics and other things that I think are a real challenge. I think that might be a good segue to me.
Yeah, sure.
To the nuclear.
I just want to say, but briefly though, sure. All of that's important, and the Nuclear Posture Review, which was billed as being the first one that ever really focused on nuclear terrorism. I guess it's true because it does talk about nuclear terrorism, some of these capabilities at length, and prior NPRs hadn't. But it didn't really break any new ground on that subject.
Right. But I think where it could be significant is that it says that this is sort of our highest priority. That this is the highest priority of the U.S. government is to focus on these issues, and therefore, if you're in the nuclear labs and other areas, that I think that means something to the bureaucracy. It means less, I think, overall for general policy, but to the bureaucracy, what is actually important to the White House and to the administration is that they focus on improving their capabilities with nuclear forensics and other issues relating to nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism.
All of which, by the way, has been ongoing, not just in the Bush 43 administration, but in the Clinton administration and going back a long way.
Right.
So.
But I think the shift in focus is significant. But so with the Nuclear Security Summit, I mean, my general reaction to the Nuclear Security Summit is, you know, why hadn't this happened over the last decade? And I think that this is, you know, we can debate, you know, how much was achieved and how little was achieved. My basic takeaway was that this is an issue in which requires multilateral cooperation, that confronting nuclear terrorism, I'll talk briefly about what the purpose of the summit was. The summit is about trying to get countries to lock down nuclear materials that they may possess. And the reason why this is important is that we know that Al-Qaeda and other groups have gone out and tried to get and acquire these nuclear materials. And some materials have gone missing. There's, you know, two guys at Harvard, Matthew Bunn, that has covers this extensively. And if you want to stay, if you don't want to lose sleep, you can go to the Belfer Center's and read his report.
There's also a database on the Nuclear Threat Initiative website of every known or reported incident of theft or loss going back to, I think it goes back to 91.
Right. Now this is a big deal. It's a big issue in which that a terrorist could steal or buy nuclear materials from facilities in Russia, from in the former Eastern Bloc, or in other countries that have nuclear reactors, and then smuggle those in through our ports, which, you know, aren't able to detect much of the highly enriched uranium that comes in, and that could build sort of a crude nuclear bomb device, explosive device, that wouldn't take that much capability to build and could blow up a city in the U.S. or a city in Europe or a city in India or a city in Russia, for that matter, as we saw with the recent terrorist attack. And that, but to address this threat requires extensive multilateralism. It requires getting other countries to actually step up and do more. And so I think the purpose of this summit in bringing all these leaders to Washington was to say that this is a major priority for the United States government. And that, you know, we expect countries to do their part to get rid of highly enriched uranium and other nuclear materials. And I think some of the bilateral things that were agreed to vis-a-vis Ukraine, Mexico, and the deal with Russia to begin destroying some plutonium.
There was a bit of sleight of hand over the Russians shutting down one of their breeder reactors, given that it's a two-year-old commitment that was announced at the summit as though it just happened.
Right. But then also, you know, a work plan getting countries to sign up to agree with to try to reach the goal within 4 years to secure all these materials. And I think importantly, having a follow-up conference in South Korea 2 years from now to sort of assess progress to see where people are, to hopefully shame countries into following suit.
I don't really disagree with any of that. I mean, yes, it's a non-binding communique. It's a non-binding work plan. So I feel obligated to criticize a little bit for that. But then again, you know, having been in government, I realize that lots of diplomatic achievements result in non-binding communiques, and sometimes they are real achievements for a lot of the reasons that you said. I do, however, think a fair criticism, which I know you disagree with, is that the issue of Iran was essentially off the table for the entire summit. And if there's going to be a nuclear terrorist event anywhere, you know, Iran is going to be very high on the list of culprits. And I think not discussing that issue drained a lot of the credibility out of the summit, and to me it was an elephant in the room, or an elephant conspicuous for its absence, let me put it that way. And also very little talk about North Korea at the summit, which is another, you know, North Korea, the arms merchant, the missile merchant to the world. There is, I would say, an operating assumption on behalf of a lot of experts that a nuclear weapon is just so sensitive and so important that no state would ever transfer it to another, and therefore we don't have to worry about that from North Korea. Well, I worry about it just because they have sold their technology, missile technology, and nuclear know-how, as far as we know, to other countries. But also, yeah. I don't know if you remember this, earth-shaking, in my opinion, report that was in the New York Times last fall. I don't remember the exact date, but it reported for the first time that the Chinese in 1982 gave the Pakistani right. government a completely finished workable copy of Fat Man with a plutonium pit. So that sort of blows up the argument that states never, ever, ever transfer the fully developed technology. You know, it's like life on another planet. Once you found one, you know, it's proof that it's there. And that scared me a lot. And it should, I think, shake people's confidence in this notion that, well, we don't so much have to worry about states getting control of these because they'll never, ever make the transfer, especially a state like Iran, which is, according to the U.S. government, still the number one state-sponsored terror in the world. It has been for years and years and years, and it has direct relationships with Hamas and Hezbollah, and this will be a controversial thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, has relationships with al-Qaeda figures, many senior figures of which have been in Iran since 9/11 and move in and out of Iran. I don't take any comfort from that.
Well, I think we need to disaggregate a little bit the two issues. That I think, you know, the conservative criticism of the summit, I mean, there hasn't been much, like, specific criticism of what was actually accomplished. I think the, you know, just quickly on your point about it not being binding, I think the fact is that, you know, the follow-up meetings that will occur in South Korea, and the fact that this is a huge priority for the White House by clearly bringing everyone here, I think that there will be follow-up in terms of, you know, the White House putting pressure on people, but not getting a binding agreement. And binding agreements, as we know, such as with the START Treaty, can be very difficult to put through. So, you know, I think you can criticize it in that sense, and I think that is, you know, a valid criticism. But I think it's been mitigated a little bit. On the issue of Iran, and I think this is where conservatives and I think progressives sort of just have a different view. That, you know, I agree with everything you said about Iran being a potential proliferation challenge, and as well as North Korea. And that is, but that is not the sole issue. That there is other ways for a transnational group to acquire nuclear materials separated from a state actually giving it to them.
Yeah. I agree with that.
But I think the criticism.
Who's going to be number one on your suspect list if you win something like that?
Well, I think the number one on my suspect list would be the crappy Russian guard that wasn't guarding the nuclear material.
Maybe. And I think, it's been 20 years and nobody is. Well, no. I mean, nuclear forensics will tell us a lot.
Right. And this is sort of my broader point. That, you know, if you're a terrorist group, it'd probably be much easier to try to acquire these materials on the black market, which people have stolen and tried to sell these things on the black market, which wouldn't be connected to any state. And therefore, you know, this summit was focused not on dealing with the challenge of Iran, which the administration is also trying to deal with, but I'm focusing on this aspect of the nuclear problem. So I think criticizing it because it wasn't focused on Iran is missing the broader picture that there is this whole other challenge.
Well, let me be clear. I am all for any effort to lock down HEU, plutonium-239, and if and to the extent that we get bilateral deals, multilateral deals to do it, we, you know, even if we have to pay for upgraded security at these other places, I am absolutely all for it.
I think this is really where the terrorist threat is the most problematic aspect of it. And I don't think that we hadn't aggressively pursued this over the last decade, and that this, I mean, we pursued it, but not made it the sort of priority that it needs to be.
We didn't have some, but I think it was a big priority.
Well, it was a big priority, but this requires we can't unilaterally decide that we are going to make all nuclear facilities around the world secure. We need other countries to do that. And I think that's part of the reason why it wasn't the number one priority of the
Richard
business.
Richard Fugger and Sam Nunn might be a little bit offended, and they'd say, wait a minute, we've been doing this since 1991. Who are you to say that it just got, now that Obama had a summit?
I mean, I'm not saying that work hasn't been done, but what I'm saying is that other countries, such as Ukraine, such as materials that are in Mexico, that may not be that well protected or that well guarded, need to be addressed. But so I think the summit was incredibly successful, and I think one of the things that is going to be important with the NPR is this issue of nuclear forensics, of trying to identify where nuclear materials comes from. I don't know enough about the science to know if it's going to be effective, but I think vis-a-vis Iran and North Korea in regards to nuclear terrorism, that there we can deter that if we do find out that an attack comes from Iran, well, I think it's pretty clear what the U.S. response will be, and it will be overwhelming. And so, but we don't have that same ability to deter, the guy in Russia who's just selling black market materials to some shadowy Al-Qaeda group. So I think that's the broader concern. But I think maybe we should close by talking about Iran briefly.
Okay. I also thought of, if you want to talk about, or you think it's worth talking about, stockpile modernization, which will be a big issue in getting START ratified. I don't know if you think it's worth it or not.
Yeah, we should definitely talk about that. So do you want to talk about Iran first, and then we can maybe close with
Iran is hard to talk about because nobody knows what's going on in there. I don't know what's going on in there. We had testimony, I guess yesterday, right, from the head of the DIA, General Cartwright. There's a new NIE being prepared. Don't know when it's going to drop. National Intelligence Estimate, by the way, for those of you in the viewing audience who don't understand the alphabet soup that we're discussing here. And, of course, this will be an update to the famous December 2007 NIE, which caused a huge furor when it proclaimed that Iran had halted their nuclear weapons program in 2003, and if you've read the footnote, it said, well, actually, they really only halted the weaponizations design, and they're still charging ahead with enrichment, which means making the nuclear fuel, which, by the way, is the really hard and expensive part. So if you're doing that and you take a break from drawing the bomb plan designs, you really haven't stopped your nuclear weapons program at all. So that NIE, I think, was kind of embarrassing, and it turned out that later the head of the CIA said he disagreed with it, and then the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, who was created after 9/11 above the head of the CIA, he said he didn't really believe it anymore. So I'm very curious to see what this new NIE will say, even though it will be classified. I'm presuming they'll put out some kind of unclassified summary like they did last time, or pieces of it will leak. Another interesting bit of news about Iran is that the Russians have been helping Iran build a reactor in the city of Bushehr for years and years and years, and the reactor has not been filled and has not gone critical. Now, it's a power reactor, but important point is that the spent fuel rods will have plutonium-239, which is bomb material, in them, which presumably the Iranians will be able to reprocess for bomb material. Nobody knows exactly all the reasons for the delay in fueling the Bushehr plant, but the Russians, I saw a story, I think it was in the Times this morning, that said that they plan to get it going by this August. And that to me is very interesting because I think if there's going to be an Israeli strike on Iran, and I don't know if there is or not, I would think that could be a trigger for it, in that if you're going to hit Iranian nuclear sites, you're going to want to hit that one in particular because you can really easily see it. I mean, the Israelis are going to have a problem bombing all of the underground enrichment facilities. They won't necessarily know how much of them they've destroyed or damaged. But you can know that you blew up the Bashar nuclear reactor just the way the Israelis blew up the Osirik reactor in Iraq, and then they blew up the Syrian reactor in 2007. It was built by the North Koreans. But if they do it, they're going to want to do it before it goes critical so that they don't end up causing a massive radioactive release into the air. So I think if the Russians actually follow through on that, it's going to be like the Bibi trips to Bibi Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, his trips to Moscow, in which it was been leaked that what he went there to say to the Russians was, listen, if you sell them these advanced air defense systems, which the Russians have promised to sell Iran, so if we see that sale taking place and that equipment start to move, that's going to be the trigger for us to go, because we don't want to have to contend with your sophisticated surface-to-air missiles. And the Russians have held up the sale, maybe because of the Israeli entreaty, maybe not. I don't know. But it'll be interesting to me to see if the Israelis make a similar appeal over the fueling of Bushehr, and B, if the Russians decide to go through with it, if that doesn't trigger a strike.
I mean, with Bushehr, what I've heard is that serious doubts that Russia will ever sort of follow through to make that.
They've certainly been slow rolling the Iranians for a long time already.
They've been slow rolling it, and I think there's expectations that they will continue to slow roll it. But you know, there's been a lot of conservative criticism of the effort to engage Iran more broadly, and the effort to go to move towards UN sanctions, which now many conservatives are saying is toothless and won't actually do anything. But
which I think is fair. I think any sanction that you can get Russia, and in particular China, to sign off and out of the Security Council, that's essentially ironclad evidence that it won't work because they won't sign on anything that will work.
Then what are the options? I mean, it seems like conservatives, where they are going, is saying that nothing is going to work except for military action.
I don't think that's right. I think that we could follow Sarkozy's advice, for instance, and pursue sanctions outside the UNSC. Try to build a coalition of other countries to put real travel restrictions on the leadership of the Iranian regime. I mean, why does Ahmadinejad have to be allowed to come to the UN? Okay, well, because of diplomatic protocol, and everybody's supposed to be allowed to come to the UN and all that. But if we're really serious about stopping them, you know, why not put real sanctions with teeth that forbid travel from senior leaders of the Iranian regime to the United States and Europe and other interested countries? Why not really go after the banking sector the way we were successfully doing in North Korea before the U.S. abruptly reversed policy on North Korea, and I guess it was 2007, and unfroze those assets, for instance, at the bank in Macau? We're not doing that. Then you could ratchet up pressure beyond that. As I'm sure you know, Iran, despite being very oil rich, can't refine enough of its own gasoline to run its automobile fleet.
My general view on sanctions is that the course that is being pursued is one that is about, you know, you get the UN sanctions, you get a sanctions regime in place. And that perhaps then later on that those can be escalated, but it is later on.
I mean, we've been doing this and trying this now for.
Well, U.S. in cooperation with others can.
And we've gotten several resolutions, and they've been found in non-compliant with the IAEA, and all kinds of things have happened.
The U.S. can do more on its sanctions. Can go further on sanctions with the Europeans, but I think the UN is an important place to begin because getting a global sort of stamp on isolating Iran is going to be critical. I mean, the U.S. ability to leverage international sanctions or unilateral sanctions against Iran, I just don't think are going to be all that effective, and I don't think have been effective in the past. And therefore, if you're going to have an effective sanctions regime,
well, there seems to be more seriousness
effectively change behavior, this has to be a broader multilateral effort.
Well, multilateral, though, can be defined in a number of ways, and I think your implicit definition is it's not multilateral, it doesn't include Russia and China, and I think Russia and China have shown,
I think it's important to
go along with anything that really hurts the regime economically or politically.
Well, I think we have to see how that's going to play out at the UN. I think that, you know, that is going to be the objective of the administration, to actually get sanctions that effectively target the Iranian regime. And, you know, I think that the Iranian regime is walked between a rock and a hard place right here. And the worst thing that we could do, I think, to actually strengthen their position is to have sanctions that blanketly affect the Iranian public, that then the regime can point to and say that this is the fault of the United States, which is trying to rally countries against us. They're the reason why our economy is collapsing. They're the reason why this green movement had taken place. So I think that, you know, we don't want to play into the regime's hands.
It's not a thing we could do. We could and should be supporting the green movement. It's inexplicable to me why we're not.
Well, I would say that the administration, I think I would agree with you, Ed, take it was slow to actually call out the Iranian regime's actions. I think that's partly because they were trying to get through certain negotiations, and also because they didn't want to play into the regime's rhetoric that this was an administration-backed thing.
I don't put that much credence in it. I mean, the same thing was said, as I recall, or I've read about in any event, about supporting Soviet dissidents and what the dissidents themselves were able to say at the time, and definitely after the fall of the Iron Curtain was, oh no, no, your support was invaluable. Yeah, of course the regime tried to say, well, we're U.S. puppets and it's just an attempt to destabilize us, but we didn't care. And every positive word that came out of a U.S. president's mouth about what we were going through, helped us immeasurably. I think the same is probably true in Iran, but current administration is buying into that argument that, oh, if we talk positively about them, the regime will say they're our puppets, and so it's better to just be silent.
I disagree with you on that, but I'm going to say something a little bit more controversial, which I know you're going to disagree with. I mean, I think it's pretty evident that the outreach that the administration did, its openness to engaging with Iran, the Nowruz message and other things that happened this time last year, that actually helped spawn a calls for change within Iran. I think it's pretty clear that...
Do you make the link?
Well, I think there's a clear link there was a new American administration that was doing direct outreach to the Iranian public and saying that we want to build a new relationship where we don't have to be adversaries. I think that helped lead many Iranians to believe that, you know, that it wasn't the United States that was the obstacle to better relations anymore, but it was their own regime. And I think there's lots of things that went on in the Green Movement that provide some evidence to that, and that therefore what happened is that the Obama administration actually got caught, that when the Green Movement actually was successful or was as potent as it was, yet the administration was trying to negotiate with the regime, it got caught between two places, and I think therefore it was slow to actually shift and be more vocally supportive of a Green Movement that I think it in some ways helped inspire.
I agree with the second half of that, meaning that's how the I think you're right. That's how the Iranian people perceive what's going on. That's how they perceive their regime, and that's to some extent how they perceive support from the American people. But I don't see any link from the Obama administration's actions, which, by the way, I interpret them entirely differently. It seems to me the Obama administration has not gone out of its way to reach out to the Iranian people, that it has instead gone out of its way to reach out to the Iranian regime, and that it has almost viewed the Green Revolution and the presence of people in the streets as an obstacle to progress of one-to-one talks, which it desperately seeks, and which, by the way, the regime has consistently given the administration the back of its hand and in very contemptuous terms.
Right, and I think that's why they're trying to pursue sanctions then. So why don't we close by shifting to the fun topic of nuclear modernization.
Right.
And just to sort of introduce it a little bit, one of the main issues that is going to be brought up vis-a-vis the new START treaty when it comes to ratification is whether our nukes are reliable or not and whether we need to spend money to modernize.
Depends on the definition of modernize. We do spend money to upkeep and test. We do spend money to upkeep and evaluate, et cetera. I guess the issue is we have not built any new nuclear weapons. I believe the last one was a W-88, was constructed in 1989, mm-hmm. and have not tested any component parts, meaning the fissile, the things that blow up, as opposed to high explosive lenses, the nuclear parts that blow up, since 1992. And I had a conversation once with a guy I'm sort of proud to know now named Thomas Reed, who's an old nuclear weapons designer. He wrote a wonderful book, which I'm going to plug, called The Nuclear Express. Everyone go out and buy it and read it. And Reed said to me that a nuclear weapon is like a Ferrari. You know, it's a very complex device. You can't keep your Ferrari in a garage for 20 years and then decide one day you're going to go out and get a carton of milk and turn it on and expect it to work. It probably won't work if you haven't done any maintenance on it. Now, it's not true that we don't do any maintenance. We do maintenance. But there is a question as to whether that maintenance is good enough, because all it does is it raises confidence based on probabilities. We don't actually know that the stockpile will work, or which weapons in it will work and which weapons won't work and which will yield what they're supposed to yield and all of that. And so this is a political issue, because John Kyle last December got all 40 Republican senators, and now we've got 41, presumably Scott Brown would sign if he could, plus Lieberman, to sign a letter to the administration saying, this is before START was even signed, but we knew what the basic outlines would be, saying essentially, if you want to get your treaty through the Senate, you're going to have to give way on stockpile modernization. And modernization to them means the building of new warheads using existing components based on old designs. But to people in the arms control community, and I'm assuming you, Max, it means it's a new nuclear weapon, which the United States should not be doing, and therefore non-starter.
Right. Well, I would say a couple of things. I would say that you know, your point about the Ferrari is right, except for the fact that we are maintaining the Ferrari, and that what's come out in the past year, the Jason Defense Advisory Panel, which is made up of scientists that go and assess the nuclear arsenal, concluded that
I can't let that pass. They didn't exactly conclude that. The executive summary
of that report, and I heard this from Tom DiAgostino the other day at a CFR briefing that was on the record, where he said there is no disagreement between the Jason panel and the lab directors. The point that you're going to make is that the lab director,
Congressman Turner, got the three lab directors to write him letters saying that the classified language in the Jason report strongly doubted whether life extension is a catch-all term for all the programs we do to maintain
the lab director said there could be other problems. Now, personally, I don't find it very shocking that lab directors, you know, want a new warhead that will, you know, give them, that will provide them lots of money. I don't find it shocking that a head of an organization is lobbying for more resources. That I don't find surprising. The Jason panel concluded that our nuclear weapons are completely reliable. That if we continue to invest in the nuclear modernization plans that we do, the programs that we currently have, and we continue to refurbish our nuclear weapons, which the new defense budget will, then, you know, these weapons are going to be reliable well into the future. And I think the other point is that I think it's kind of rich that conservatives are now, you know, attacking the administration for nuclear modernization when the Obama administration announced a 13% increase in the amount of money going to nuclear modernization.
Well, it's a legitimate question as to whether or not that 13% increase was a way of, in a sense, buying off the opposition, saying, look, you're not going to get exactly what you want, but we are going to give you a lot of money, but you're just not allowed to use it on the program that you really most want to use it on. Now, I don't think this is a closed question yet. And by the way, for the listening audience, Thomas DiAgostino is the head of the Energy Department's National Nuclear Security Administration, which maintains the stockpile of nuclear weapons. And the Jason Commission is a sort of floating commission of various scientists who are not in government but have been affiliated with government that comes together from time to time under DOE, Department of Energy auspices, to study complicated tasks, including in this case to study the reliability of the stockpile. Now, this is not a closed question, and I think the reason it's not a closed question, first of all, look at what DiAgostino said and what General Cartwright, the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said the day the NPR was released. They left the barn door pretty open for something like the reliable replacement warhead, which was the Bush program to update the stockpile, which has been formally canceled, but seems to be like a kind of a Frankenstein monster in the bureaucracy that never is, maybe it's Jason or something. It's one of those monsters that never seems to be quite dead, no matter how many stakes you put in it. And I think, you know, this brings us back full circle to the very first point I made about the little mendacity over the treaty provision on missile defense that got the administration in trouble. And I think that ironically made something like RRW more likely, because by ticking off Kyle and McCain over both the mendacity and the fact of the missile defense provision, they raised the price for getting that treaty ratified. And they may now really be forced to have to give in a big way on stockpile modernization in order to assuage Republican, you know, ill feelings over that.
Well, what I would say is a couple of things, and I think you're right. I think your readout of the situation is right, that RRW, or, you know, making a concession on that, may become the price that we have to get a START treaty that is very modest and doesn't actually, according to your argument early, doesn't actually require us to reduce nuclear weapons, which I find, you know, sort of incredibly frustrating.
Just let me just butt in right here. We will, the United States, as a matter of policy, we will actually... There's no question that we will actually stick to the 1550 deployment cap. I don't have any doubt about that.
I think that's
and,
clear.
And the Russians,
but the verification measures, the important verification measures that are would evaporate if START doesn't ratify. I mean, I think my broader point is that I think it's rather it's two things. One, we don't need the RRW, and that's we can disagree with it.
I'm not so sure. But, I mean, I don't understand the physics well enough to know, but you know, I try to keep up with what various experts are saying, and I'm not convinced we don't need it.
Right. Well, and from my view and from people I talk to, we don't really need it. But that the administration may concede, and so there were some loopholes within the NPR and some statements from some officials, although Ellen Pauscher did say that she's the Undersecretary of State, did say that the RRW is dead.
She is the most diehard opponent of it in the government, right, apart from maybe the vice president.
Right. And I think with good reason, because if you're going to build a new warhead, that kind of sends a bad signal that you're actually serious about disarmament. I think it doesn't help us.
Well, let me just respond to that.
Let me just okay. So I think the price could be that we have to build this new nuclear warhead. But I think I think the arguments that are being made for it have nothing to do with the START treaty. And so that this is essentially, after months of conservative
They do have something to do with the START treaty, because the argument is if we're going to keep drawing down the size of the force, then we can't be in a situation where, unbeknownst to us, some substantial percentage of them don't work, and we find that out in the midst.
Well, there's a contradiction in a lot of the argumentation about the significance of START treaty then, because if we're going to significantly reduce, then it's not fair to say that the START treaty isn't far-reaching, because then, if we're going to cut nuclear weapons, which many conservatives have said that the START treaty doesn't do, then we don't need a new reliable replacement warhead. There's a contradiction.
I just wanted to point out that the bomber counting rule was it's gimmicky, and it's a bit inaccurate, okay, and misleading to claim a 30% cut when really the letter of the treaty allows for a 10% increase, which of course you and I know neither side is going to go up by 10% as a matter of operational practice.
But I think the other thing is that the administration is investing in nuclear modernization. It is refurbishing nuclear weapons, and that the critiques and complaints that have come out of from a lot of the lab directors are about the Bush administration, that these are newfound concerns that we are not among all John Kyle has always been for the RRW. But the idea that START is going to be contingent on the RRW is something that I think is unique, because this is a Democratic administration and not a Republican administration. And I think that these are, highly political concerns, and that the arguments that are being made about the RRW and about nuclear modernization are not sort of serious policy arguments, but are ones. I mean,
let me put it this way: you may be right about that. I don't think you are, but we now have an arsenal in which the youngest weapon is 20 years old, 21 years old, as far as I know. The longer we wait, LEP, life extension program, the current refurbishing kind of things we do, are not going to extend the lives of those warheads forever. So at some point, we're going to have to do something. We're going to have to do something that looks like the RRW, whether it's now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And the last point I will make, and I'll give you the last word, is I just don't buy the argument that us doing RRW sends this bad signal to the world. I don't think, for instance, if we were to do the RRW, the fissile pit in the weapon would be from existing material, because the U.S. hasn't made HEU since 1964 or plutonium-239 since 1988. We don't make this stuff anymore. Most of the components would be reused. The design itself, which D'Agostino reaffirmed at a press conference a couple of weeks ago, would be an older existing design. It would not substantially – basically, the physical parts of the thing wouldn't be new, and the design wouldn't be new. It would only be a new weapon in that all of those things would be put together in that one place for the first time. It's like, as I said in my piece, it's like going to the junkyard and getting all the parts to a car and then pulling a design from a 57 Chevy out of a file cabinet and putting it together in your garage. Is it a new car? Sort of. Is it an old car? In a lot of ways, yeah, it's an old car. And I don't think us doing that will have any effect at all on Iran or any other country's decision to pursue a nuclear program.
Well, what I would say just to that briefly is that I think the way we deal with our nuclear weapons is that we modernize and update, we refurbish them. And as Stephen Pfeiffer of the Brookings Institution said, that if you take the weapon that we had, 20 years ago when we originally built it, and the ones that we have now, that they're incredibly different. That we've maybe a few bolts are still the same, but we've been throughout the years changing the parts and updating them. I live in a 100-year-old house. It's not the same house as it was when it was built in 1907. That things have happened to modernize and renovate that house to make it completely livable, completely fine, more energy efficient. And so I think the same thing sort of applies to our nuclear arsenal. That I don't think we need the RRW, and I think that is I think it does send the wrong signal, because the signals that it sends is that we are serious about building. I think these are essentially new nuclear warheads. We can try to claim that they're not, but that we would be building new nuclear warheads while at the same time saying that we are going to disarm and bring weapons down. I just think it sends a very bad signal. But the last
we might end up building them and yet still have a total stockpile that's smaller. And also keep in mind the RRW, the point of the RRW is, you know, it's not like updating your house. It's a deliberately less sophisticated design than, for instance, the W88, which is the most sophisticated design currently in the U.S. arsenal. It's deliberately less sophisticated so that it degrades at a slower rate, and it's just easier to maintain, and its lifespan will be longer. And in being less sophisticated than the W88, it also, among other things, has a lower yield. So replacing high-yield, complicated weapons, highly miniaturized weapons that were meant for MIRVs, with a lower yield, less complicated weapon that's not really MIRVable, that's sort of too big and bulky and heavy to be MIRV, I don't see, that seems to me to be a moving in a direction that an arms controller would want.
Right. Well, we'll agree to disagree there. I think the last thing, just to close, that I would say is, I think when it comes to the START Treaty and linking it to RRW, I think the argument that the administration needs to make, and I think the argument that they will make, is that the consequences of not getting a new START Treaty, I think, are very high and very severe. That if any conservative, and which there are many, is paranoid about Russian intentions, the fact is that this new treaty extends the verification framework that is vital to knowing what's going on with the Russian nuclear arsenal. And I think, you know, it would have devastating consequences for U.S.-Russia relations. It would have devastating consequences for the world's, in the world's eyes, for our commitment to disarmament. I think it would have devastating consequences for the non-proliferation regime. So if I was in the administration, I think that's the argument that I would try to hammer. But
I'm not going to make an argument against ratification, but I think that's pretty vastly overstated. I mean, I think, you know, START 2 was not ratified, and it didn't have any great impact.
But you still had the START 1 verification.
And the people who, by the way, and even if this isn't ratified, like I say, I know our side will abide by it in any event, as if it were ratified. And I think people who are worried about Russian intentions, including me and Russian behavior, we're not really worried that the Russians are going to launch a nuclear strike, which in any event, we can keep track of a lot of their delivery systems using other varieties of intelligence, even without the verification procedures. It's not to say that those are worthless, but it's not like they're all we have. We're worried about Russia doing other things, and my firm belief is that even if we ratify START, Russia's still going to do all of those other things that we're worried about, and they're not going to stop or slow down just because of ratification.
Sure. Well, why don't we leave it at that? And,
okay, great.
Michael, thanks so much for
great talking with you. I appreciate it. I had a good time.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks a lot.